Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. There was a rare fatal cougar attack near North Bend over the weekend. We'll tell you what happened and what we might learn from that. I hope you can stay tuned. It is harder for seniors to stay in their homes in Seattle than in many parts of the country, thanks to our rising rents and property taxes. So what happens when seniors have to leave their neighborhoods? KUOW reporter Joshua McNichols went asking.
Victoria Marshall was born in 1945, so she's full of stories. She can talk about the 4 years she was homeless, or her deep knowledge of animals, which she shares with people at the zoo. She used to live on Capitol Hill, but now she lives at the far northern edge of the city.
Seniors are being pushed away from daily life. So if somebody wants wisdom from old people, they're not going to get it. Because we're out here, all alone, isolated away from the community.
Marshall described her neighborhood on Aurora Avenue North as a kind of senior ghetto.
We have to make an extra effort on our parts to go be part of a community. And sometimes that's a problem, because we're not always well. We don't always have money to travel or the time to do so. I don't know. Yeah, it just feels really isolated.
That isolation is a problem. That's why Shag, a developer of senior housing, hired Muhammad Iqbal. His job is helping seniors connect to a community wherever they're living.
You know, the more active you stay, the more engaged you stay, the more you enjoy in your life.
Shag's newest project is in Tukwila. It's right down the street from Foster High School, one of the most diverse high schools in the state. The school has a large immigrant population, and many struggle with their English as they struggle with their homework. Every day after school, many of those students pass by the senior housing.
They usually walk to the library to do their homework. So, and that's our building, actually, across the street.
All right, so like I can imagine a senior looking out their window, and then they see all the high school students come by.
Yes.
They're like, oh, it's time to go mentor somebody with their homework.
Yes, and mentoring is everything. You know, someone is sharing with you their lifetime of experience while you are 16 and 17.
Shag has always tried to connect its seniors with activities, but they're going further with this project in Tukwila. They've located right in the middle of a community that could use some more seniors with time on their hands. I went to a luncheon for future residents of the new senior apartments going up in Tukwila, and that's where I met Joyce Faber.
Where I did live, it was too much money.
But it wasn't only the money that brought her to this place.
I raised a grandchild, and when he left, I said, oh, now I'm all by myself.
Faber has a lifetime of experience she plans to make use of in Tukwila.
I taught school for a while, volunteer at the school, anything that I can do to help the community.
That may work for Tukwila, but there's a cost to the city that loses its seniors. Victoria Marshall offered this story as an illustration.
You might have noticed I'm not wearing my dentures.
One day at the zoo, a kid looked at her and said,
no teeth. And I went, yeah, and that was the end of it. But kids don't get to see old, sick, toothless adults. The only toothless people they get to see are other kids. They don't know anything about what it's going to be like to be old. And that's part of what you need to learn when you're growing up.
So if all Seattle's seniors were to move away, Seattle's kids would be the ones who lose. In Tukwila, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Hundreds of seniors are moving to an old stretch of highway in Seattle, once known for crime and prostitution. We'll have that story for you later this afternoon on KUOW. Two Seattle residents were biking, mountain biking, near the Cascade Foothills this weekend when a cougar attacked them. S.J. Brooks was killed. Isaac Sederbaum is in the hospital. He's in satisfactory condition. Cougar attacks are so rare here that this was the first fatal attack in our state in almost a century. So what do we take away from this attack? My guest is conservation ecologist Chris Morgan. Good to talk with you again, Chris.
Hey, Bill.
What happened on
Thank
that?
You having me.
What happened on that trail, Chris?
Well, it sounds like these two gentlemen were mountain biking through the forest. At one point, they turned around and saw a cougar chasing them. They sped up to try and get away from it, but they weren't gaining ground. So they stopped, did everything that you should do, shouted, waved, yelled, were as aggressive as possible to the cat, towards the cat, but it didn't work. The cougar kept on approaching. The gentleman who survived used the bike to actually hit the cougar. There was actually hair found on the sprocket of the bike, so that's where he was hitting the cougar. The cat then took off, and the two men stayed on the location there. You could just imagine them trying to sort of assess what was happening and collecting themselves. And then the cat came out, jumped on the gentleman who ended up surviving. He let go of his bike, fought back, sustained some injuries, punched and fought the cat. The other gentleman ran into the woods, which sadly triggered a chase response from the cat, which attacked this gentleman. And meanwhile, the surviving man left the scene, jumped on his bicycle 2 miles out to get to a cell signal, and managed to call the police in. But at that point, the gentleman had been killed by this cat. So an incredibly rare and tragic incident. My heart goes out to the family of this gentleman.
A lot of us bike and hike in that part of the mountains and the foothills and are wondering, what should we do? So will you again recap general advice when it comes to a rare cougar attack?
Yeah, just so incredibly rare. Like you say, Bill, I mean, there's been 20 incidences really in this last 100 years or so, and eight of those were serious injury or death, and only two of them resulted in deaths, in fatalities, and that included the gentleman this weekend. So incredibly rare, but still sort of knowing what to do when you're going into cougar country or into the wild in Washington. First of all, I think remembering it's impossible to eliminate all threats, and it's not necessarily what we want as Washingtonians going into a sort of a sterile environment. We want this sense of the wild, but really making sure that you know what to look for in cougar country, looking for tracks and scat and scrapes, scratches, cache sites, knowing what you're looking for, sort of being aware of your surroundings.
But meaning what, Chris? If we see scat, that we do what with that information?
Well, I mean, just to be aware that there are cats in the area. We've got around 34,000 square miles of cougar habitat in Washington State, so there's a very decent chance that you're in cougar habitat. You can carry bear spray. It works on cougars as well as it does on bears or deer or elk or any other animal that might be acting aggressively. Carry something to make noise. If you're on a bike, make it a bicycle bell or even a whistle. Give a whistle every 5 minutes or so, and just helps all animals realize that you're in the environment and gives them a heads up. It's a respectful thing to do. Gives them a chance to get out of your way. But again, eliminating all threats is never going to be possible. You know, this was a young cat. It was probably a 3-year-old male, which should usually weigh 130, 140 pounds. It was 30 pounds or more underweight. I know that Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is going to do a really thorough necropsy independently over at WSU to see if there's anything wrong with this cat.
Well, what questions would you have about a necropsy, Chris?
Well, they might they could reveal any number of things, from rabies to brain abscess to anything that may have been wrong with this cat to make it act in this way, as it is such a rare incident. So the time will tell when the results come through from that, through WDFW.
Well, the workers killed the cougar, so what difference is it? Why do they now want to know why possibly this cougar attacked?
Well, I think with any incident like this, the more we know, the more we can try to avoid these happening in the future, you know, just arming the public with knowledge about what to do and what not to do when you're in the wild areas of Washington State, or ultimately in your backyard in many people's cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's about 2,100 cougars in Washington State, and I'm on a trail very often here near my home in Bellingham. I do this trail. I've done it hundreds of times, and I've never once seen a track on it. I've never once seen a cougar scat on it. But a year or so ago, I encountered a cougar on that trail, and it quietly melted into the forest and walked away from me. I managed to get it on a remote camera a few months later, but I would never have known it was there if it wasn't for the fact that I saw it and then got it on camera. So my point being is that they're there. They're often observing us when we don't know it and we don't see them. They are very good at being elusive and secretive and usually mind their own business. But in this tragic case, it turned out differently.
You said make noise, and it sounds like you're also saying don't run from a cougar. And does that go for same on a mountain bike? Don't flee. Is that right?
Yeah. Ultimately, escaping from a cougar that's in pursuit mode by running is not going to work. So fighting back, I mean, and these gentlemen did that. It sounds like they really sort of tried to fight this cougar off and were very aggressive. They were doing all the right things by the sound of things. But yes, you should never run. It triggers a different response in a cougar. And yeah, it's just their natural instinct to chase something down, as it might be with anyone who owns a house cat sees that behavior daily.
Yeah. And if making noise and they were swinging the bike at the cat, at the cougar, if that doesn't work and it's down to it, can an adult fight off a cougar? I mean, what would you do if your hiking partner is being attacked?
Well, Bill, that's a really difficult question to answer. I mean, I can't imagine the shock and adrenaline that was flowing through those guys as this was unfolding. It's just unimaginable. The bottom line is, though, it's just fight for your life with an incident like this, where it appears to be a cat that was acting in a predatory way. It was a predacious attack, so it was treating these guys as if they were prey items. And so the only thing you can do in that situation is fight as hard as you can.
Why is it? Again, we're talking with conservation ecologist Chris Morgan, and you were telling us how rare cougar attacks are. You said 20 in what time period, like the last century?
20 over this last 100 years is what the WDF records show, yes.
In this area. And why is that so rare?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, these cats are very predisposed to secrecy and being elusive, and it's their hunting technique. They rely upon that elusive ability to hunt and to kill deer and elk and other small mammals. You know, they'll eat any number of small mammals, from beavers to small rodents to coyotes, and all of it involves stealth. So they're very secretive, very elusive, and highly paranoid about humans. Like a lot of these big carnivores in this part of the world, they've been persecuted for a long time, and they know it. Humans are not good news for them, so they avoid them at all costs. And just in rare instances like this, where they're driven to desperation, does a tragic incident like this happen.
So then as humans spread out into the foothills more and more, do you expect cougar attacks to become more common?
That's hard to say. I mean, if you were thinking logically about it, that would make sense. I mean, there's 7.5 million people almost in the state right now, and outdoor recreation is exploding. Anyone who spends time on their local trail can see numbers of people increasing on them all the time. And so where we are increasing and expanding is definitely into cougar range. It's into black bear range. It's into this habitat that has up until now been secure and quiet and safe for them. And now they've got human neighbors that are there on a daily basis. So yeah, I don't think we're going to see any sort of hockey stick graph of increase in attacks or incidences, but certainly over time, per capita, interactions and encounters could increase for sure, yeah.
Two more questions, Chris.
I think sometimes it's almost more alarming, it's more surprising, sorry, to me, that things don't happen more often like this, you know, with the number of carnivores on the landscape in Washington State, so...
Yeah, I want to ask two things, Chris. Do you think anyone you talked about how you wouldn't want us to try to eliminate all threats? You said, do you have any advice or thoughts to someone who is maybe they're new to the area and but in either case they're wondering about going biking or hiking in this area of the North Cascades? Is there anything you want to say about that decision?
Well, I would encourage people to get out and enjoy the outdoors and understand that we live in this jewel of a place that comes with wild risk. And if you're willing to take some sense of risk as part of the experience in the outdoor, then that's part of the beauty and majesty of this place that we call home. It doesn't make the incident on Saturday any easier, though. I mean, one death is too many, and we all need to do what we can to minimize the risks, but you can do it with certain things like the knowledge that you're armed with and carrying the right tools like bear pepper spray and take a whistle with you or a bell, and don't travel alone, hike or mountain bike in pairs or more, and just make sure that you sort of travel respectfully for the wild place that you're in and enjoy it. But remember that there is this level of risk that you're either willing to take or you're not, I guess.
And that leads me to my last point, that I associate you with advocating for reintroducing grizzly bears to the North Cascade. So from what I know about you, you're not rethinking your desire for there to be the glory and the risk of the grizzly in our neighborhood.
No, I'm not rethinking it. No, I think it's an opportunity here in the Northwest to do something quite special for grizzlies. And the restoration of grizzlies here is likely to go ahead from what we're hearing. And so, of course, with that comes this need for more knowledge, you know, people to know more about these grizzlies, which have been absent for so many decades. And it's part of the same story of accepting that wild element in this area of the world where this is possible for us to coexist, you know.
Again, we've been talking about this cougar attack near North Bend over the weekend. A cougar attacked two Seattle residents who were mountain biking there and killed one of them, S.J. Brooks. And Isaac Sederbaum is in the hospital in satisfactory condition at last report. Chris Morgan is a conservation ecologist. His work includes grizzlies and wolves and cougars here in the Pacific Northwest. Chris, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in a moment. How much should a teenage conviction follow you in your adulthood? Sports fans in Corvallis, Oregon are asking that. The question might come to Mariners fans. This is the story of an Oregon State baseball star who pled guilty 7 years ago to molesting a child. New York Times reporter Kurt Streeter wrote the story. He's based here in Seattle. Kurt, welcome to KUOW.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill.
This might seem like a Friday Night Lights story. It is not football in the Deep South. It's top-tier college baseball in the Pacific Northwest. Will you take us to the OSU baseball program briefly?
Well, Oregon State baseball is a very big deal down in Corvallis, where, you know, their football team is traditionally not great. Yeah. Their basketball team has had glory days in the past, but certainly not, any time in recent memory. And, you know, men's baseball is really where it's at for Oregon State athletics. They've won two national championships. They're a perennial national power. And this year, once again, they're one of the best teams in the country. They've got a great chance to win the College World Series this year in Omaha.
And this pitcher, Luke Heimlich, he might end up in Major League Baseball. He's that good.
Luke Heimlich is one of the best pitchers in college baseball. I spoke with numerous front office people for major league teams who told me that, you know, he projects talent-wise to be a starting pitcher in the major leagues. He's that good. They don't believe he's an absolute all-star Hall of Famer, but he's a guy who would be a very solid addition to most major league teams.
What did Luke Heimlich admit to when he was 15 years old?
He admitted to molesting his niece, who was 6 years old at the time. He pled guilty to this, and he denied having ever done this. In his telling, he says that he's actually maintained innocence all along.
What does he mean, he maintained innocence but pled guilty?
Well, behind the scenes, he did, apparently. He was ordered, for instance, into court-ordered counseling, and he says that all along he was telling the counselor, I didn't do this. You know, he felt that he not only got bad legal advice, but he was just really pressured into a very difficult situation where he pled guilty in order to essentially make it go away, because at the time he felt that if he pled to this, went through the probation and through counseling, this would be off his record and nobody would ever know about it.
And no one did know for quite a while. How did the public find out about this?
When he was a student at Oregon State, he had moved down to Corvallis, and when he turned 21, it's my understanding that by Oregon State law, you're supposed to update your location as a sex offender. He was supposed to constantly be registered as a sex offender. He apparently did not do that. That somehow tipped off authorities to give him a citation. And a Portland, Oregonian reporter then found out that he was on this registry. The Oregonian reporter was working on a feature story about him and just did a routine background check then. And his name popped up. So it was simply really by mistake by him. If he had given authorities his whereabouts at the time, this probably would have never been known.
Now, I haven't heard anyone suggest that someone who has pled guilty to child molestation shouldn't be allowed to be a student at Oregon State University, but some people are saying he shouldn't be on their baseball team, whether he admits it now or not.
Well, to most of the fans, most of the ones that I talk to, certainly, they're willing to move on, and they want to move on from this story, and they're willing to completely forgive. They believe that he has paid his price to society. Fact is, his case has run its course. He served 5 years of probation, and that's all done. He was a juvenile at the time. So they believe, the way fans tend to, that it's simply a matter of moving on and accepting where he is right now. And by most accounts, he's a model citizen in Corvallis. However, there are others, of course, who say that somebody like Luke Heimlich, who has pled guilty to molestation at any point in their lives, should not be representing the university through a sports team. I talked to the mother of the victim in this case, and she was absolutely adamant that, in her belief, that Mr. Heimlich should not be playing college baseball and should not play in the professional ranks because, as she put it, when her daughter turns on the television and sees him, say, in the pros, this will continue to live on for her daughter in a way that she would rather it not.
Yeah, she was a bit nuanced about it when she said, I don't think he's a terrible person, but I think he's done something terrible.
Exactly.
Talking with Kurt Streeter of the New York Times, who's written this story about Oregon State University baseball star pitcher Luke Heimlich. This story is about questions of forgiveness, but it's also about our love of sports and athletes.
Well, it really is. I mean, I'm always struck by the willingness of fans to forgive, and especially from star players for their actions. There's many players in the professional ranks that have been accused and in some cases even found guilty in some form, of things like sexual abuse or battery and things like that.
Yeah, domestic violence. On video, punching somebody.
Sure, but, it's a different era right now. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what happens to Heimlich going forward, in the era of the Me Too movement. How will people who are hoping to play professional sports and have a past, if the Mariners were to draft him, bring him aboard, and he's a starting pitcher for the Mariners, what are the optics for that in Seattle?
Have the Mariners commented to you about any
no,
of this?
No, they did not, and I did not reach out to them.
Kurt, do you want to offer an opinion of what you think Luke Heimlich's future is? At OSU, with Major League Baseball, do you have any guess?
I don't. And I try to stay out of the opinion game, really. It's very, very hard to say what's going to happen. Luke says that he's been contacted by most of the Major League teams. I asked him in 5 years and 10 years, where will you be? And he absolutely believes that he'll be playing professional baseball.
Do you know anything, Kurt, about how this now 12-year-old girl is doing? Did her mother say anything to you about what it's going to be like for their family to go forward?
She wouldn't give me specifics, but she made it sound as if her daughter is a very, very strong person. But she made, it was an interesting comment. She spoke about how, we just simply never know. And this is true. If somebody is abused, the psyche is a delicate and complex thing. Who knows how this will end up affecting her daughter in the future?
What else stands out to you, Kurt? You've reported this story. You've been in that stadium in Corvallis, Oregon.
What I was really struck by was being in that stadium down in Corvallis and where the team is so beloved. Just like, good teams all over the country, top teams, and Heimlich is so beloved there. And the fans that I spoke to, one after another, just completely willing to just absolutely move on. But the contrast between that adoration and then to speak to a season ticket holder at Oregon State who is an avid baseball fan, a huge supporter of the baseball team, and also told me that she had been sexually abused as a child, and the way that the emotion that I felt from her and how she goes to the games when Heimlich pitches and she roots for the team when they're at bat, but when he is pitching, she stays silent. She absolutely doesn't believe that he should be there. And yet she supports the team fully and hopes that they go to the College World Series. And if they do go to the College World Series, she may end up going to Omaha in June. In a way, she really encapsulates a lot of the complexity of this case.
New York Times national sports feature writer Kurt Streeter. Thanks for writing it. Thanks for telling us about it, Kurt.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
And to give you an idea, Puyallup High alumnus Luke Heimlich is having quite the strong season on the field. He's 13-1, leading the Pac-12 in strikeouts. The National Collegiate Baseball Writers Association just named him National Pitcher of the Week last week. Stay tuned to The Record. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk Royal Wedding with John Roderick and Leah Baltus. So stick around. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Were you one of the 29 million Americans that tuned into the royal wedding over the weekend? Even if you didn't watch, you may have heard a bit.
So darling, darling, stand by me.
That's a Church of England wedding. That's Karen Gibson and the Kingdom Choir at the wedding of Prince Harry and American actress Meghan Markle, now the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. And here to discuss the wedding and some of the weekend's other happenings, Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine, and John Roderick, singer, guitarist with the band The Long Winters. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in. So nearly 1 in 10 Americans watched the royal wedding, including, I understand, Leah Baltus. Why did you care enough to DVR a stranger's wedding?
Well, I have to confess that I did go to college with Meghan Markle. I did not know her, but it did pique my interest just enough to DVR it and watch it on fast forward.
And what did you find? What was the most surprising thing about watching the wedding?
I mean, it was really moving. I thought they did an amazing job planning the whole thing out to make it seem really intentional, and to have the, you know, big deal of Meghan joining the royal family actually pay off in ways that seemed meaningful and like they might have some kind of impact, or at least be some kind of a tonic in the dystopia that we're living in.
Favorite moment? One moment?
Probably that choir performance you just played, the Stand By Me.
John Roderick, are you a royal watcher, a royal don't carer? You are a royal, by the way. Last we talked about you being the king of the seafair.
That's right. I'm Seattle royalty, seafair king, presently, still part of my, I'm in my waning days of my tenure.
Where's your crown?
I don't wear it, but I do. I am wearing crown motif underwear.
Okay, so a lame duck King Neptune. What did you make of the wedding?
I am a royal fan. I'm an Anglophile. I watch the Queen. But I didn't watch the wedding because I guess it just seemed like a wedding. But I did read about it on the blogs. I got the wedding filtered by other people's opinion. So I, you know, obviously, like in today's world, you can't not have an opinion. But,
yes.
But, you know, I agree. I think it was it appeared to be a lovely ceremony, and it seems like a watershed moment.
Couple of things so many people are talking about, how black the wedding was, biracial bride, black gospel choir, black cello soloist, Oprah Winfrey, Idris Elba, and the sermon from Bishop Michael Curry, the first black head of the U.S. Episcopal Church.
When love is the way, there's plenty good room. Plenty good room for all of God's children. Because when love is the way, we actually treat each other, well, like we are actually family.
Not just saying we're family. What if we treated each other like we're actually family? I got a whiff from the blogs that the royal family was reacting to his sermon. They were
surprised, delighted,
agape. I'm not sure.
Amazed.
Yeah,
watching the faces of the immediate family was definitely amusing. Although they didn't seem to be, you know, on the verge of giggles in a dismissive or condescending way. More just like the shock, maybe, of having been so mired in the usual stuffiness for so long that they couldn't believe what was happening.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. I have to point out, you know, the New York Times called it a hugely symbolic moment with the potential to change the world's view of the royal family and perhaps Britain's view of itself. On the other hand, the black English sociologist Kehinde Andrews said, we're getting distracted from real issues of British racism. Quote, Meghan Markle is not a dark-skinned, afro-haired, flat-nosed black woman. She represents the image of blackness we've been sold as acceptable and marketable. The best hope is the nation forgets about Markle's blackness and she blends in, effectively passing for white. The worst-case scenario is that Markle comes to represent a symbol for racial progress in Britain, which obviously that professor thinks she is not.
Right. I mean, the royal family, although generations or two back, represent imperialism in every sense of the word, the current generation has always seemed to me to be both very progressive politically and also, I mean, Charles and Diana were have done work in this realm long before their kids were born, right? They were not, you don't go back in and find any transcripts of Charles or Diana being exclusionary. And Charles has worked really hard his whole life. So I get the sense of the royal family as being a lot further along than you might think, given that they are like this very symbol of tradition. You know, and the England abolished slavery first, right? So they do have a legacy. I mean, obviously, racism in England now is as much a problem as it is here. And anti-immigrant sentiment, like that's pervasive in Europe as well. But I think this is I think they're more progressive than we give them credit for.
I mean, they let this all happen, right? The Queen approved the plan.
Yeah,
right?
Embraced it even.
And Meghan didn't just take the path of least resistance, it would appear. The Duchess of Sussex made a lot of choices to really assert her heritage in a way that seemed strong-willed.
And her husband had her, was at her side through it all.
And what about, Leah, what about the idea of this being a feminist wedding? Did it come off that way when you DVR'd it?
I mean, I think it's kind of a big deal for anyone who has anything resembling a traditional wedding to decide exactly how you're coming down the aisle. And the fact that she entered the church alone was a pretty strong statement. And obviously her fingerprints were all over it, which showed her agency in the midst of a lot of powerful folks. So in that sense, I thought it was pretty feminist.
All right. Well, I just couldn't believe it was a Givenchy dress. I mean, I was thinking Sarah Burton, maybe a designer.
But the designer is British.
Yes.
Well, and also, I love that you guys know how to pronounce it. I was like, Givenchy.
$45 million wedding. And wow. My wife and I pulled off a wedding for half that. So it just seems extravagant. And Anthony Bourdain, by the way, said, I'm all for love, but if you're attending the royal wedding, I kind of automatically don't like you. And that set off a whole, what do you think of people who care or don't care?
Well, and that's the other thing, right? I mean, class was traditionally the conversation that we had around a royal wedding.
Yeah.
It was a very different conversation that we're having about this wedding, and that also feels like a progression.
I want to talk about a couple of other things. One, a disaster that happened over the weekend. We were just discussing earlier in the show these two mountain bikers attacked by a cougar near North Bend, and one of them was killed, and I was asking this conservation ecologist, what should you do? And this guy is working hard to reintroduce grizzly bears to the North Cascades. So one of his big messages is, well, here's what you should do. And one death is a disaster, and it's one too many. On the other hand, we're not trying to remove all the danger from nature. How did you react to the? It's a very rare attack. Even a cougar attack is rare, much less a fatal one.
It is, although I know a man who's been attacked by a cougar in Montana. He was jogging on a logging trail, and a cougar was high up above him on a kind of a cut, and jumped on his back. And he was a guy from Butte, Montana, so he and the lion fought one another to a standstill. So he was shredded, but he recognized that what you don't let a mountain lion do, the mountain lion is going to try and roll on its back and get you on top of it, and then it'll eviscerate you.
So it's got the four claws?
Well, and its hind claws are where its strength is, and it'll take your guts out. Right. So he didn't let it do that, and he fought this thing off. The cougar got his backpack off, and after they were facing one another in a standoff, the cougar went over and peed on his backpack and then disappeared into the forest.
Leah, does that, the presence of that kind of danger, however rare, does that affect whether you're out in the mountains in the foothills or not?
I'm an avoider of wilderness.
Yeah?
Yeah, I have Lyme disease. It hasn't treated me well.
No, that's awful.
Nice. So, I mean, it's funny, though. I was actually just reading this Urban Bestiary book like 2 weeks ago by a local author, and she writes about how rare it is for cougars to attack and raccoons, and I was feeling all better, And then this headline came out this weekend. It's so sad, of course, and, you got to feel terribly for the families of these people. But at the same time, like, is it because they were on bikes and they were looking quadrupedal and so they seemed more like a typical prey? Is it because the cougar was so emaciated? Is it because, who knows? But beware.
Yes, you can go online here pretty soon and listen to the best advice and thoughts of this conservation ecologist, Chris Morgan. Well, how did you get Lyme disease?
I went to the forest near the Wenatchee River, just east or west of Leavenworth, and was bitten by a bad, bad tick.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. It's been like 10 years. I'm pretty functional, but it's not an enjoyable process. So, you know, DEET.
Yes.
Some of this
yes.
stuff is a reminder that we, you know, what we love about living in the Northwest is our proximity to nature and the wilderness, but that has responsibilities. And we tend to think because we've built freeways that we've domesticated the wild, but we haven't. And if you want to go to these places, you wear a bell and you're conscious of the fact that it's not your turf. This turf belongs to the wild.
Yeah. Wear a bell, make a lot of noise, don't run.
Put that your was hands this... up in the air and
yes.
make yourself big.
One more thing over the weekend. I saw researchers at UC Irvine. They concluded that songs are getting sadder, at least in the UK. They looked at the top 100 singles. I don't know why just the UK, between 1985 and July 2015. And they concluded that the public prefers happier songs, but more and more unhappy songs are being released every year. In other words,
I hate to turn up out of the blue uninvited, but I couldn't stay away. I couldn't fight it. I had hoped you'd see my face and that you'd be reminded that for me it isn't over. Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
John Roderick, you're blurry through my tears. You are a musician. What do you have to say about unhappy songs?
I'm a musician and I write almost exclusively unhappy songs.
Why?
I think that they're at a certain point, as pop has evolved, it's become more and more emotional, more and more acceptable to express, the tracks of my tears style emotion rather than get up, standing up, or, you know, like party music.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, as R&B has evolved to become a big part of our popular culture, I mean, that all comes from church music, and a lot of that is very impassioned, personal music. And I think just culturally, we talk a lot more about our emotions than my father or even my, you know, older brothers' generations did.
Yeah.
It's just part of the way we interact with each other now. We are much more candid about how we feel.
Drake seems like a modern rapper. you brought us a favorite sad song, Leah. This is Morphine's In Spite of Me.
Last night, I told a stranger all about you. This smile.
Are you drawn to the sad songs too?
Oh yeah, I love feel bad TV. I love, you know, get the emotions out. I like to sing along. I've been known to listen to that song for at least 4 hours on end on repeat. You know,
if you listen to the recording of that, even you hear a plosive on the microphone at one point. It's very raw recording. And that's not a thing that we would have ever let through in the 70s or 80s.
Right.
So we've lost polish, but in favor of intimacy.
Well, there you go. Songs, even upbeat. I mean, the beats are, a lot of it is dance music, but these researchers concluding that the lyrical content is getting unhappier and unhappier. For me, it's Can't Stop the Feeling by Justin Timberlake. It makes me despondent.
What, you like rock and roll? You like happy songs?
I'll do a little of both. You know, I love the John Prine song, Sam Stone. There's a hole in my in daddy's arm where the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. You don't get lower than that.
That's pretty hard.
But if you're going hard with the low, then yeah, absolutely. Bring it on. We've been talking with our guests and weekend watchers, John Roderick, singer, guitarist with the band The Long Winters, Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. Let's come back and recap another weekend.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Thanks, guys.
I got this feeling.
Oh, it makes me cry.
Inside my bones. It goes electric, wavy when I turn it on. Off from my city, off from my home.
We're flying up, no ceiling when we in our zone. I got that sunshine in my pocket.
It's the Record on KUOW. This morning, the Supreme Court handed down a decision that the notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she called it egregiously wrong. Slate said it legalizes wage theft. What happened? What does it mean? Here to explain, Professor Eric Schnapper, University of Washington School of Law. He's handled more than 80 Supreme Court cases. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Will you remind us why class action status is so important to workers and troublesome to business? That's the backdrop here, right?
Well, it's not just workers. It's consumers and people affected by in a number of practices. There are many claims that are so small that as a practical matter, it would make no economic sense to bring them individually. And they're small enough that you couldn't get a lawyer as well. In those kinds of circumstances, unless class actions can proceed, the laws just don't get enforced.
Right.
And that's the problem here.
So what did the Supreme Court ruling say today?
Well, this is the most recent of a series of Supreme Court decisions permitting the use of binding arbitration to limit legal remedies. And one of the common features of binding arbitration is that the arbitration agreement, which is written by the defendant, in this case the employer,
and the employee signs the agreement?
That's not necessarily.
Oh.
The agreement, the words are written by the employer, and they commonly ban class actions. You'll see the same thing, and Bill, have undoubtedly signed onto that many times with your credit cards and your bank statements, and when you rent cars.
Okay.
They commonly ban class actions. In the case of employees, they may well never sign anything. There may just be a rule book somewhere that says if you work here, you're agreeing to go to arbitration. Sometimes people sign things, but often not.
And so up to now, the employees were able to say, well, I might have agreed, or you might have written this language that I have to go to arbitration, but you can't make me. I can join a class action?
That was the question. Employees are protected by the National Labor Relations Act, which provides that employees have a right to engage in what the statute calls concerted action. They can do things together. So a strike would be a classic example of concerted action. So the question that arose here was, would bringing a lawsuit with a couple of other workers be concerted action under the statute and protected by the National Labor Relations Act so that you couldn't give up that right by signing an agreement? That was the question. So it wasn't clear what the answer was here. The argument that was made that was bought by Justice Ginsburg, but not by the majority, was that these kinds of bargaining agreements can't be enforced if they bar class actions. But yeah, it was only for employees. It wouldn't have covered consumers.
So when, for example, Slate says this legalizes wage theft, we can argue that in a moment, but what do they mean?
Well, I think probably in fairness to business, you really have to distinguish between two kinds of employers. The problem about violating the minimum wage laws and the overtime laws is that employers make money by breaking the law, which isn't true of all laws. If you engage in sexual harassment, you don't make money off it. So there are employers who quite consciously break those laws because every dollar you pick from your workers' pockets is a dollar in profits. There are also employers who have to make decisions about how close to the line they're going to go. There are areas where it's just not clear whether what you're doing would violate the minimum wage laws or not. One of the purposes of liability is to deter people from doing things that might well be illegal because they're going to be liable if they do. You are not going to work very hard to make sure you're not breaking the law under this decision because the law has become unenforceable.
Five out of the nine justices, they made this case, the sort of pro-business case. What is that business case for this ruling?
Well, this was a very technical decision about the interrelationship between the Federal Arbitration Act and the National Labor Relations Act. It rested on the wording of the statutes. The argument made by the majority wasn't that business is good and workers are bad. It fell along the normal liberal conservative lines, but it was at bottom, from the majority, a technical decision about the wording of the statutes.
So statutes can change. Is there something that might happen in individual states, for example, Washington State? Well, how will people react to this?
The Washington legislature could do things to address this. First of all, it could authorize the state attorney general to bring lawsuits on behalf of workers or consumers whose rights are violated. Those lawsuits would not be affected by this decision or the Federal Arbitration Act. There are states where attorneys general can do that sort of thing. I think it would be a good idea here. Secondly, it could make it illegal to fire a worker who wouldn't sign one of these agreements. It's not at all clear that an employer couldn't do that today, and I think that would be a sensible sort of protection. California also has a law preventing private lawyers to sue sort of like an attorney general. That's a less clear area of the law.
Do you think a much talked about hypothetical Democratic takeover of Congress in the midterms would change, would Democrats go after this legally?
There's been support on the Hill for changing this whole area of the law about binding arbitration. It's gained a lot of visibility because binding arbitration was used in the Stormy Daniels case to try to keep her from discussing her claims publicly. And there's been support on the Democratic side of the aisle for dealing with this. I think it's probably not realistic to think anything's going to happen as long as the current occupants in the White House.
Would this ruling affect the case of that porn actress Stormy Daniels?
No.
Okay.
She wasn't an employee of the president. And that was more of, it's an unusual turn of phrase here, arm's length relationship in that they probably did negotiate over the terms of that agreement, and it's conceivable that she could have said, I won't agree to arbitration, and they could have said, well, then we'll only give you $90,000. And it was more of an arm's length negotiation at that point, even though the relationship apparently was not.
Yes.
But employees, and then that's different. Employees don't have that choice.
So overall, Professor, what is the state of play when it comes to the balance of power between business and labor so far into the Gorsuch-Trump administration?
I'm not sure either Gorsuch or the president would want to be bound together in a sentence quite like that.
Uh-huh.
But given at this point in time, I mean, clearly this has shifted the balance of power away from workers and towards employers. Not every employer does this, and I think those who don't deserve commendation for that. I think it's important not to paint all employers with the same brush.
Yeah, when we're considering that constant back and forth between business and labor and how the court strikes the balance, I wonder where you think we are in the scale and where we might be headed, future rulings, future laws.
It is not difficult to overstate the importance of ideology in the Supreme Court. Most cases aren't decided by 5-4 votes. When the court divides, it doesn't always divide on liberal-conservative lines. I've handled a lot of employment cases in the court. The vast majority of them have been decided 9-0. I've only had a couple that were decided 5-4. So this isn't a good day for workers, but I think it would be inappropriate to read this as a sign that a majority of the court is intent upon, you know, stamping out all worker rights and giving all power to the employers.
Is there a local employer who you think is an example of a business that and whose employees would be affected by this ruling? Is there a local case?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the employment rules are at different firms. I think this is the sort of thing that's it's not fair to employees, and we'd be better off if this practice stopped. But I don't know what the local situation is.
We've been talking with Professor Eric Schnapper, University of Washington School of Law. He's handled more than 80 Supreme Court cases. What's the next big Supreme Court case you're looking out for?
Not in this area. I think we're all looking to see what happens about the president's Muslim ban. I think that's one of the big unresolved issues this year.
Any predictions?
No.
Hard to tell. Okay. Well, that's why we watch it. Professor Schnapper, thanks a lot for this.
My pleasure.
That's our show. The Record is produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrenpong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.